Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. Today we have TW publisher and founder Martha Nichols talking with author Sean Michaels. In addition to three novels over the past 10 years, Sean has also written widely for various publications and founded the music blog Said the Gramophone in March 2003. Said the Gramophone was one of the early MP3 blogs alongside others such as Stereo Gum and Buzz Grinder. Sean's first book, 2014's Us Conductors, is a fictional autobiography of Lev Terramin, inventor of the electronic musical instrument, the theremin. It won the Giller Prize that year. His second, 2019's The Wager, is, in his words, his clumsy way of writing about making art and the meaning of life. Most of Martha's conversation with Sean focuses on his latest novel, Do You Remember Being Born? The novel's main human character, a famous poet named Marianne Farmer, bears an eerie resemblance to the real poet Marianne Moore, a modernist icon who became something of a celebrity herself toward the end of her life. And in the book, Farmer enters into a collaboration with an AI model, Charlotte, to produce poetry.
Welcome, Sean. I'm delighted to be talking with you about generative AI and writing because I think you're going to challenge some of my own perspective about the use of this technology. We're meeting by Zoom in May 2024, a time when many artists, musicians, and writers have begun experimenting with generative AI in their creative work. Now, I have qualms about writers using AI in this way, but I'll also say that your 2023 novel, Do You Remember Being Born, is fabulous. And you did include some sections that were produced with AI. In fact, it was one of my favorite novels I read last year, precisely because it so directly addresses how we create ourselves and our personas, especially in fiction. So in our conversation today, we're mostly going to talk about how you wrote Do You Remember Being Born, but I suspect it will stray into other multimedia and interactive projects you've produced. And I'd certainly like to talk with you more generally about your attitude toward generative AI and how it can be used creatively. So let's start with you describing Do You Remember Being Born. What's it about? I have lots of thoughts about this, but I'd like to hear your take on the premise and your main character, who's a famous poet in our time who seems suspiciously like Marianne Moore. So why don't you take it away?
It's great to be here, first of all. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely.
Do You Remember Being Born is the story of a 75-year-old poet named Marianne Farmer, who lives in New York in a little apartment where she has lived all her life writing poems. She wears a tricorn hat and a cape. And although she has had a very distinguished career, she is a poet. You know, her prestige might be high, but her means are slim. She has an adult son. And one day, out of nowhere, she receives a letter from a big tech company in California inviting her to come to Silicon Valley and spend 1 week writing a historic poetic collaboration with their new poetry AI named Charlotte. And the book follows the course of those 7 days as she works out if or how or can she or will she or should she or shouldn't she write that poem with Charlotte.
That's a great Precis. It really is. It kind of gives the overall feel for it. And one of my big questions, of course, is why did you decide to create an avatar of Marianne Moore, who was a real extremely famous poet, especially towards the end of her life, famous in ways that I think many people don't really know who are alive right now how famous she was.
That's right.
But maybe you could say a little bit about Marianne Moore, especially for people who are not familiar with her biography or with her poetry.
Yes. So when I began, the seed of this book was back in 2019. That's when it was born. And I had one of the things that happened is that I had stumbled across an early large language model, so a version of what would be called technically GPT-2. So you can kind of think of it as a grandparent of something like ChatGPT. And I'd come across a website that let you play with this AI tool, and I found it extremely unsettling, bewildering, and inspiring, and at times sort of astonishing. But I didn't it was provocative to me, but I didn't really know what to make of it or what to say about it or what I thought about it. I felt it was sort of gross. it sort of made me a little bit disgusted, and at the same time it made me quite, you know, it had a magical feeling, both things together. And there's also something weird about just like engaging with some sort of corporate product, writing product, this commoditized thing that made me feel dirty. And anyway, I didn't know what to make of it. And then it was around the same time that I stumbled upon, in an essay in The New Yorker, the story of Marianne Moore and what happened to her in 1955 with the Ford Motor Car Company. And so Marianne Moore, as you say, was this, you know, famous, great 20th century modernist poet, contemporary of T.S. Eliot, who, you know, was really a fascinating just character, person. She wore a tricorn hat and a cape. She wrote poetry all her life, but became famous, as you say, as she became older, into her 50s and 60s and beyond. And when she did become famous, she became famous in a way that poets never get to be famous anymore, it seems like. You know, she was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. She threw the first pitch at a Yankees game. She wrote the liner notes for an album by Muhammad Ali. So she was this public intellectual who was witty and profound and cutting and kind of a model for what the artist's mind can be. And yet, in this position of sort of power and authority and of clear-sightedness, she received a letter in 1955 from Ford, the car company, asking if she would be interested in helping them name their new car. And instead of turning her back on this invitation, turning up her nose at it, she was deeply tantalized and spent months writing them letters, almost with a kind of pleading note to them, suggesting wonderful, fantastic names for cars, like the Ford Fabergé, the Ford Silver Sword, the Ford Pastelogram, Utopian Turtle Top, Mongoose Civic. I mean, I can go on. There's a whole book of them. Ford rejected them all and just went with the Ford Edsel.
But, which was a lemon.
Which was a lemon. It was a huge flop.
That's the real irony of this whole story. But yeah, her names are so fabulous.
They're great. I mean, maybe it would have turned the car around. But I found myself in 2019, suddenly this was kind of the static electricity kind of jump between two ideas, where I found myself thinking about what Marianne Moore would have thought and would have said to technology like this, and how a figure like that might have been sort of lured into waltzing with the machine, just as she'd been lured, just as the real Marianne Moore had been kind of tempted into cooperating with a different kind of industrial machine. And that's how the book was born.
Your character, Marianne Farmer, and you use, Farmer is spelled with two F's, big F, little F, which I think is a very Marianne Moore kind of thing. But she is a very compelling character in your novel. But one thing I thought about a lot here is that Marianne Moore famously lived with her mother until she was 60. Mm-hmm. That was when her mother died.
And slept in the same bed as her mother, in fact.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And you have some of that in your novel as well. That's part of mm-hmm. Marianne Farmer's story as well. But many critics have referred, sometimes very dismissively, to her symbiotic relationship with her mother mm-hmm. and how it affected the voice of her poetry. And I was wondering if you channeled some of that symbiotic voice into Marianne for your novel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if symbiotic is the word I would use, but I have to say, you know, as much as I talk about this AI stuff being kind of at the seed of the book, what really interested me most was a figure like Marianne Moore, or certainly my fictional Marianne Farmer, who's not exactly the same. But I found myself really interested and provoked by this idea of the solitary, artistic, poetic genius. And it mm-hmm. seemed like Marianne Moore, in a lot of ways, some of them quite sad, was sort of this, is this paragon of the kind of insular, insulated poet. And you start to wonder, looking at her life, like how much of her kind of nun-like, you know, she never had relationships, she didn't have children, how much of this was because of her, you know, self-doubt or self-image, how much of it was about her close, too close relationship with her mother, how much of it might have been connected to queerness, though she never spoke about that. But how much of it also might have been related to just an idea that the pure poet, that her poetry and her art benefited from its isolation, and that by mm-hmm. being in this kind of Manhattan apartment tower, high in her tower, with her mother in this place of safety, how that was a source of power in her work. And to me, that was a kind of provocative and commonly held thought. I had become a father a few years before. I have an 8-year-old son now. And again, there too, I'd been thinking about the way that some artists have complained about the strain that puts on art making, the artistic practice, and the way that we have a kind of expectation even that men who have like ambition, particularly men who have ambition, whether it's artistic ambition or entrepreneurial ambition, it's like kind of appropriate that they have to wall themselves off from the distractions of the home in order to, you know, make something great, build something great. And I kind of reject that. I do reject that mm-hmm. as a dad and as an artist. And I kind of wanted to, I found myself really thinking about the ways that something like AI, something like that kind of collaboration was a sort of metaphor for all the other kinds of collaboration that many artists, such as Marianne Moore, kind of felt they were obliged to reject for the sake of some kind of artistic or creative purity.
So before we go any farther, let's just hear a little bit of Marianne's voice. And I was going to have you read two short excerpts, one from the very beginning of the book and one very close to the end. Okay. And so the first one is on page 2, and it starts with her talking about the letter she has received from the company, and that starts, "Dear Marianne Farmer." And if you could just read to the end of page 2 in my copy of the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
"Dear Marianne Farmer," the letter began, "you are one of the great writers of this century. The company was asking me to collaborate with them on a poem, an historic partnership between human and machine. 1 week in California, composing a long poem with a 2.5 trillion parameter neural network, which is to say an artificial intelligence, a robot, a genie in a bottle. Excerpts from the finished work would be published internationally, with the complete poem appearing online." The letter concluded by stating that they would be pleased to offer me $65,000 for my contribution.
Okay, so that's the opening setup. And then let's shift to page 226, which is mm-hmm. near the end of your novel. The paragraph that begins, "My whole life I had believed."
"My whole life I had believed that understanding myself required me to keep others at a distance, lined up on the far side of a river. That evening of counting, I had not felt so certain. That evening, I felt like a room with doors open for others to explore, and that from their explorations, I could start to ascertain my shape. We are not the people we think. We cannot really see who we are. Here, on Sunday in San Francisco, I had the same impression that I might unfasten the locks and lower the drawbridge, that I might not be a fortress, but a space for others to pass through.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's lovely. I'm wondering if in creating Marion, the character of Marion, who's sort of the center of mm-hmm. this book, although you go in a lot of interesting places with it, if you were, the whole process of creating her was something of a parallel to the way an AI might construct a character. Did you think about it that way, or did you think about it differently?
I thought about it differently. I was really kind of using... I was not setting out to write an imaginary Marianne Moore, like Marianne Moore setting, taking place in the future. My first novel is... an imagined, dreamed version of the life of the inventor of a musical instrument called the theremin. And the protagonist of that book, my protagonist, is Lev Sergeyevich Theremin, which is the name of a real historical figure. And I'd already experienced the kind of tangle that it can be when you're mixing up a fictional character with a real person, and that mm-hmm. how readers get confused, and there's different ethical considerations. And with this, I was like, I'm not writing a book about Marianne Moore. I'm writing a book that I want to write, the book I want to write, and I'm using aspects of Marianne Moore's life to inspire me. And so I really feel like I came to it as a novelist who's like plucking ideas, like from someone you might know. You know, I want to write a story that takes some of the early life of my friend Albert and then mixes in the teen adolescence of my friend Julie and so on.
I think what you're describing is kind of what all novelists do, right?
Yes.
You know, it's a magpie thing. You know, you're bringing in these different things and then it becomes something else once you're
Believe that there's something, like I really felt at a certain point, I didn't come in with that intention, but at a certain point of working on the book, I did find myself reflecting a lot on some of the sort of criticisms that are levied against AI, that, you know, that it's just pretending, you know, that it never mm-hmm. had a body, it never lived these things, it never, et cetera, all the things that are mm-hmm. true.
Yeah.
And because I was very conscious of the fact that I also had never lived as a woman, you know, I was not a 75-year-old woman, and that I have the capacity to imagine, you know, whether I imagine it poorly or I render it well, but I'm also kind of making things up and kind of projecting myself into bodies and lives and experiences that aren't mine, and that some of those criticisms that are levied against AI felt like they ought to also be levied against novelists. And anyway, I found myself feeling like a peer, like a colleague of the AI in that sense.
In this novel, you also shift from Marion's first person perspective for contemporary narrative. Mm-hmm. to these sort of hindsight sections, you call hindsight sections that convey her history. Mm-hmm. And in that one, the voice is writing in you when recounting her past. And in fact, the novel ends in the second person voice. So why did you do that?
Do you have any hypotheses?
Oh, you're giving it back to me. I think it has something to do with the way we construct ourselves, and that we construct ourselves in many different voices. I mean, I'm somebody who loves nonfiction, personal nonfiction, but I'm well aware that any nonfiction writer is still constructing yes. a persona, a version of themselves, right, to convey to readers. And I think she needed, I would say that to tell her history, she had to stand at a distance. Mm-hmm. She had to stand at a distance to not tell it from the first person. Mm-hmm. Because speaking in the first person voice, even if it's a persona, I almost switched to the second person voice there. I almost said, you feel more vulnerable.
Yeah,
I feel more vulnerable.
Right? Yeah.
So there is that.
Yeah.
That kind of switch back and forth. And I'm very aware of it as an editor also of nonfiction writers doing this all the time. So those are a few hypotheses. What
okay,
would you
those
say,
are good.
Sean?
I mean, I think you're very right. I wanted to give possible backstory to Marion's character and fill in details about her past and tell us something. But I also wanted to do it in such a way, or I realized I could do it in such a way that opened up this little chink of possibility that it need not necessarily be her remembering, but could actually be someone or something else imagining. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really curious at a certain point thinking, well, what would an AI such as Charlotte, how might it backfill a life if you were to give it your writing? You know, if I were to give an AI everything I had ever written and all of my emails and a biography of me, what is the story it might tell of my life? How closely would it match the real story? And I was interested in kind of giving Marion a backstory that left open a kind of, or left it in a kind of liminal flux kind of place where this could be her story or it could be a sort of dreamed, intuited version of her story. Mm-hmm. And I was also interested in the way that it becomes like a crazy sort of weird multi-layer, quite, you know, like, is this really what happened to Marion or not really what happened to Marion? And then it's like, well, it's all made up by me, Shawn Michaels, a writer in Montreal. Like, none of it really happened to Marion. And this kind of level of what the reader's conception of truth being this kind of very funny, weird thing that is scrambled by a lot of the questions that the book is examining. And so that's the short answer, I think.
So the part I thought I would have you read, and it's interesting that when you're talking about what a chatbot or one of these generative AI systems might do if we fed it all of our writing and all of our biographical information and everything that's ever been written about us or whatever into one thing. And that's actually something we could do right now if we wanted to with some of these systems, right? Mm-hmm. What would it come up with? And one of the things you did is in these hindsight sections is you would list Marion's age at the time, mm-hmm. when she's like looking back, mm-hmm. I'm assuming. So mm-hmm. it's not just from when she's 75, but in this one, she's age 34. So, and it's the one, it's on page 91. And if you could just, you could read the whole first paragraph there. That'd be great.
Hindsight, age 34. You were born on Halloween. The delivery took place at home, but you were told that the attending midwife arrived at the doorstep in a flowered headband with a stripe of coal across her brows, Frida Kahlo. Father was dressed as a skeleton. It seems important that he went ahead and put on the costume even after Mother was in the throes. They were my only clean clothes, he is alleged to have said. In his defense, there was not much to it. A black turtleneck and work pants with painted lines. One can see him in the photographs from the following morning, leaning against your mother, supine, softly exultant. Your father, the skeleton, in handmade black and white. You used to imagine him taking out the garments again, afterward, in later weeks or months, trying to decide whether he ought to throw them away. You never found them in Mother's closets.
Now, I mean, I think that's a wonderful description. I don't know how much of it comes literally from Marianne Moore's life, as I believe she lost her father early on, or, you know, and possibly he committed suicide. I don't remember all the details exactly. But it's so particular. It's so lyrical. So as I asked you before, I asked, are you a poet? Do you write poetry yourself?
Yeah, no, I'm really not a poet. And like, I don't, in as much as I don't write poems, but when I started working on this book, I realized pretty early that it just wouldn't work. The book wouldn't stand up if it didn't incorporate the poetry that they were working on. If it was just this mm-hmm. vacuum at the center of the book, it would just make it this hollow thing. So I realized that pretty quick I had to include some of the poem that Charlotte and Marion are working together. And so then I had to write their poetry, which I like to think of as fictional poetry, because it's like, it's poetry that's really not my poems, you know, it's the poems of these characters, but it's definitely something I was really nervous about. The handful of first readers I had were all poets, because I wanted to see if the poetry could pass, you know, if it passed as fictional poems.
It does kind of pass in almost a spooky way at certain points, and which is part of what, you know, I, as somebody who loves poetry and has read it for many, many years.
I love poetry.
I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it in the reading of having to question what makes that poetry and what makes that line, you know. And you sort of brought in some lines of some of Marianne Moore's really famous poems at different points, which I occasionally recognized. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see the AI riffing off.
Well, I mean, for a lot of reasons. One is the Marianne Moore reference, but I also find it, you know, we have this history, and Marianne Moore was actually, you know, we have a history of music sampling, right? Of samples in music. And Marianne Moore she loved to sample in her poems. Her poems have tons of quotations, not necessarily with quotation marks, you know, like she was a collage.
Well, yeah.
She was a collagist. And again, like this aspect of the AI as this synthesis, you know, one of the sinister aspects of AI is that it's a collagist, and like you might not know it's collaging. Where is it collaging from? And I found there was something kind of, I took a perverse pleasure in saying, well, how does it feel if I also commit the same crime? Is it different when I do it or when a computer does it? Why? In what ways? Think, like, sit with that. Let's think about it. Not because I know the answer, but because I think it's interesting. You know, there's a lot of claims of the copyright infringement of AI-generated works, which I think is a really valid legal question to sit over and think about. But I would defend very strongly the right for artists to quote and, you know, infuse our work with other people's work. It's really a nourishing part of being part of an artistic lineage. You kind of have to knock those things together and try to figure out what to make of it.
I think the thing about the copyright suits, that has everything to do with the business practices of these corporate entities that have just taken all this work and sucked it up. But I feel
can
very
Can I ask you
different.
A question then?
Yes, you can.
So, when you say that the problem is with the companies or with and with their technology or with the companies and the, maybe their irresponsible use of it, does that mean that the solutions for you are calling on companies to be more responsible in what they allow these things to do, or is it calling on companies to compensate people differently?
I think it's to actually be more responsible in how they are putting, you know, the compensating people. There's an issue there. I mean, the New York Times has got a lawsuit going on right now. We'll see what happens there. Mm-hmm. I think that's a tough one in some ways. It's going to be a tough one for current copyright law.
Yeah.
But, and I do think compensation is an issue, but I think has more to do with sort of unthinking replacement of human writers and artists with technology, because what the technology produces is good enough and we just want productivity. You know, that's a problem. That that comes from, you know, sort of business thinking about this. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, and I just did a Substack piece about another one about Sam Altman, where what I really want him to do, he's got a huge bully pulpit right now. Mm-hmm. He like appeared at Harvard. He had 1,000, you know, students agog listening to him, right? It's what I want him to do is I want him to say, you know, writing is about thinking. And no, you shouldn't just use ChatGPT and not learn to be a writer. You should learn to be a writer first. You should learn to be an artist first. You should learn to code first. Yeah. He's said stuff like that before, but he hasn't said, you should learn to write and read. And then, this technology is probably going to really spark you and help you.
Right.
But if you don't know how to write, you know, that's where, you know, we start dumbing down everybody. Yes. You know, and that's where I see the problem more than, you know, strictly in terms of copyright or ripoffs or that kind of stuff.
I think that's very astute. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I like being called astute. A few more questions for you, Ed, and then I think we'll wrap this up. I have many more questions for you. I'm not sure how many I'm going to get to, but I think this is it's very fascinating to talk about how AI is going to affect all of us who are writers, who are journalists, and all of that. So I'm wondering, how has researching and writing this book or novel changed your own views on writing and authorship?
It's definitely messed with them and made me self-conscious in different ways. So, I mean, some of the things that I've reflected on, I haven't quite figured out what to make of these thoughts. And they're in the book in large part, or many of them are. But, you know, it's made me think differently. One example is, you know, seeing the AI-generated text, not being able to work out if it's genius or terrible. You know, especially more like creative and strange AI-generated text. And then having the same reflection on my own work. Like, is this genius or is this terrible? Not really being sure, and then being unsettled by, like, why can't I tell? What does that mean? And then realizing that humans' capacity is meaning makers. You know, if I write a random collection of images, if I say the sun looked like a glass of lemonade or something without thinking, humans will nod and stroke their chins and think, oh, that's really kind of beautiful. And then if an AI makes a random association, it's very easy for us to do the exact same thing. And so I start to wonder, as Marion reflects in the book, like how much of what I've written is a deception? Like, how many things have I written that are kind of arbitrary and mindless? And I don't think many, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, like, how would I know? Because we're so good at making meaning from. I've also thought a lot about, I know I've read in some of your essays that you're aware of this variable called temperature, which is just the way that you can kind of dial up AIs to be more random in their selections of word choices and less random. And so if you tell it, you know, the snow was as white as, and then it's going to say, or her skin was as white as, it's always going to say snow, 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 snow. And as you dial up the temperature, it starts to say her skin was as white as milk, or her skin was as white as the moon, or like it gets stranger.
Oh, marshmallows.
Marshmallows, yeah. Yes. And like, that's interesting that you can dial up temperature and it becomes more kind of quote unquote, or like could be seen as being creative. I have struggled as I try to figure out for myself, in what ways is my creativity different than just more random? Like, in what ways is it more complicated than just choosing more, making a more random choice? And I'm not really sure. I think it is, but I haven't been able to work out. Basically, something like temperature, which is like, oh, that's all they have for creativity. I'm not sure the ways in which I'm different. So all that stuff has made it so that whenever I write now, I'm differently critical, different. I ask different questions of my work a little bit. I've been provoked by the apparent creativity of machines to question a little bit more the creativity of humans. And it's also, I mean, it is make, I like to hope that as we get more and more like crummy AI generated work out there, that it starts to raise, for some people, it raises our expectations of human work. And so I've also noticed that I read some not very well written books recently on the beach. And I found myself really like wanting more of them, thinking like, really, that's the best you could do, in a way that, you know, I'm like, a computer could have written this, which isn't a thought I would have had 10 years ago.
Right. Well, and that's certainly what the people that run Netflix thing too, you know, that's, I mean, because they're just churning out all the stuff that's so formulaic that as far as I'm concerned, a chatbot could write a lot about that or, you know, or do a script for based on some of these ideas, you know. But again, I think there is that issue about there's both the ethics of it, like, should we cut humans out and replace their jobs, basically? That's a, you know, this question. But then there's also the kind of thing that you're posing here, which what makes my creativity human, me?
Yes.
I think it does have to do with voice.
Yes.
That's absolutely what I feel strongly. I think that's one of the things that AI undercuts. And as writers, we need to understand how it undercuts it, because you're right. AI is really good at what's called divergent thinking.
Yes. But I wonder, Martha, like, basically, I do think there's something about context windows here. So, like, the earlier AIs and ChatGPT for sure, basically, the more of your work, the more of a given sample you can give the AI, the better it gets at mimicking voice. I really feel that. Mm-hmm. And just like the AI, the graphic generators can really do these uncanny, like, Wes Anderson take on a given topic. You know, like, those images is like, here's Wes Anderson's version of the Wong Kar-wai. They're really good at these visual voice mimicry. I do think that once we're playing more often with, like, the latest version of Gemini and so on that have bigger context windows, which is just to say, if I upload 100,000 words of my work, its ability to mimic my voice is much more eerie than it was if you're just giving it a page of your work. And I'm not as convinced that that voice thing is as clear a delineation as I'd like it to be. But what it can't do is make up my voice from scratch. You know, like,
no, that's, it can't. That
my, like, it can mimic it once I've got one. But
right.
Can't make
and
up its own
I mean, there are certain things that it cannot do. I mean, even if we start to, you know, walk into a total surveillance society where there's cameras everywhere recording our every move, it really is not embodied and it can't kind of live forward in time in the same way. Right. And I mean, this is important for, sort of daily, like, what's my life like? What do I feel like? And certainly important for anything that is painful or suffering, you know, any kind of suffering or something like that. That's where I think I do see huge limitations in all of my tests with it. It's like, it can't go there.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's one of my last questions for you. Because I thought about this towards the end of your novel. I wondered, you created this character of Charlotte. She's a poetry bot, but she's character, I think. Mm-hmm. Do you think that she achieves consciousness by the end?
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of the private conceits of the book is, like, I'm allowing her to maybe be alive. So, yeah, I think so. You get into some real deep philosophy here. You know, obviously, we've made decisions, ethical decisions, and each of us makes different ethical decisions about what is conscious. You know, we believe that people who are in comas are conscious, even though they can no longer interact. We believe that infants, our newborns, are conscious, even though they've got almost no capacity to, but we don't think, you know, that dolphins are, you know, a non-vegetarian, I'm not a vegetarian, non-vegetarian, you know, like, I would preserve the life of a newborn or a human in a coma, but I would not preserve the life as carefully of a dolphin. You know, it's completely hypocritical. But if you're going to start making, that's based on this kind of fundamental, this early decision that humans are conscious and other things aren't. And so as soon as you start opening the door and saying non-human consciousness and sentience exists and is equivalent, then you've kind of got to say, you got to have a test. If something lives up to the test, it passes the test. And I have a feeling that those tests are going to be very hard to keep software from passing over the next decade.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I think so, too. And I think part of what is going to become the challenge for creative people moving forward, humans moving forward, is how do we work with these other kinds of consciousnesses? How do we make that part of this larger landscape, this larger imaginative landscape?
Yeah.
I mean, certainly many fantasy writers, science fiction writers have done that. But it does open up things in interesting ways, potentially good ways. That's why I feel like I don't want to just come down and say, you know, writers should never use, you know, generative AI. It's terrible. It's not good for, I know it's not good for students who don't know how to write. I'm very sure about that. I've been doing, you know, teaching for years. It's very clear to me that it's bad for them. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily, you know, bad for creative work.
The plea I would make, or one of the pleas I would make to Sam Altman and his peers, like the one that you made earlier in connection with that, is if we are going to have a broader ecology of writing partners, or maybe consciousnesses one day, but certainly like collaborators, I would say let's try to have as rich an ecology as possible. And so right now we've got these very singular, authoritarian, monumental, like one or two or three products that all kind of speak in the same God voice. And I think we would be richer, and a lot of the threats and fears around this would be diminished if we had a whole bunch of frogs and goblins and bats and robots and droids and all kinds of strange AIs that work in different ways and have different strengths and weaknesses, and that it was more of a cacophony and less of just like speaking to this one computer mind, and that's where we would be headed.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.